Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. Later this hour, the classic Christmas film It's a Wonderful Life gives us a fictional glimpse of small-town USA in the 20s, 30s, and 40s. I will talk with historian Leo Landis about life in Bedford Falls and what it can tell us. But first, when the war in Afghanistan ended, the world watched last-minute efforts to evacuate more than 130,000 Afghans. The U.S. has promised to resettle at least 50,000 Afghan refugees in the United States, and that process is underway. By late November, approximately 23,000 Afghan refugees had been resettled. It's a complicated process that brings with it many challenges for everyone involved. This hour, I'll talk with people who are helping Afghan refugees make their new homes in Iowa. In a few minutes, I'll talk with Aaron Bell, who volunteers as a coordinator with the Des Moines Registry Refugee Support Group. But first, Mock Sucheska is bureau chief of the Iowa Bureau of Refugee Services based in Des Moines. Hello, Mock.
Hey, Charity. Good morning. Nice to hear from you again.
Well, thank you for coming back to the show. And just tell me a little bit about how this process is going. Of course, the world watched as Afghans were evacuated. We know about so many Afghan refugees winding up at military bases around the country and around the globe. And we know that a lot of people have been waiting a long time to get into homes. Tell me about this process from your perspective.
Yeah, well, I appreciate the question. And, you know, you kind of alluded to it in your opening remarks on the situation. It's been a very complex and complicated situation, but overall, things are going well. The resettlement process in itself is a cumbersome one. We know that this unprecedented time has posed a lot of challenges and circumstances that we haven't faced as a network for some time. But I'm happy to report that all of the partners and agencies that we've been working with to ensure a successful and safe resettlement of our Afghan partners is going well, and going as well as it can given the circumstances. With the challenges that we faced, we've been able to address those challenges head on, not only through our partnerships with state agencies from top down with Governor Reynolds' office, Iowa Workforce Development, to name a few, but also our local partners, our resettlement agencies, the ethnic community-based organizations that are really fighting the good fight and working very hard every day to ensure that our most vulnerable residents have the supports they need to survive and thrive in their new home that will be Iowa. So I'm happy to report that things are going well, that we're moving along accordingly, and any challenges that may come up or arise, we are tackling them head on through conversations, community collaborations, and just overall networking to ensure that everyone has what they need to succeed, and post-resettlement services to survive and thrive, as I mentioned.
So, of course, we know that there were a lot of people that needed help right away. So that's an incredible challenge. And it was an international effort to care for people as they were evacuated from Afghanistan. But tell me a little bit about why this is so challenging here in the United States, because this is kind of an unprecedented effort, at least for many years.
Well, yeah, you kind of took the words right out of my mouth. I was going to say that it is an unprecedented time. If we were to look at a historical context, we would have to go back to the late 90s with the Kosovar crisis, where there were some similarities to the modern day with the Afghan evacuation. But given the just scope and magnitude of the situation, our involvement in Afghanistan for 20 years, there was just a lot more weight to the overall situation. Not only that, the evacuation of Afghans and bringing them over to the United States posed another infrastructural challenge that that we were able to address. But in the beginning, we had some rough patches. I would say overall things are beginning to taper and streamline, where we can now successfully administer those resettlement services once folks do arrive to their final destination. The big difference between sort of the traditional route of refugee resettlement and what we've seen with the Afghan evacuation is that people were directly brought to the United States as opposed to being processed in a second country where refugees who have to cross an international border, seek asylum in a second country, and then go through that process of application, approval, and then final destination. We've seen that entire refugee process condensed into about 3 to 5 months at one of our military bases across the country. So these bases that were not initially equipped to be refugee camps or refugee asylum destinations had to really ramp up their processes and protocols to ensure that there was an infrastructure in place to adequately, successfully, and safely process individuals for final destination. With that, the integrity of the overall refugee resettlement processing system was not compromised. Vetting processes were in place and are continuing to be. Folks are going through medical screenings, seeking, receiving some basic community orientation and medical supports and needs they may need before travel is approved. So we're really seeing on a micro level the entirety of the refugee resettlement processing and final destination to for travel being condensed into, like I mentioned, 3 to 5 months. So the big piece to remember and for the viewers on here today is to note that the integrity has not been compromised of that process. Even though we are looking at a shortened timeline, the security background checks, the vetting process, medical screenings, all of that are being conducted and ensured that they are completed to the best of to the one's ability. And once people are given the green light, they can arrive. And if there's anything that comes back that may be a red flag or they're we just need further clarity on travel and final destination is placed on hold until further notice.
Well, let's talk about travel and final destination. How is that decided? Where a family is going to wind up?
Sure. Initially, at the onset of the evacuation, when people were brought to the military bases, a big focus was given to communities across the country that had established Afghan communities. The primary locations where people were being resettled to, or at least given priority to travel, were California, Texas, and Northern Virginia. But just given the scope and magnitude of the circumstances, that sort of process was thrown out the window, and any community that was willing to receive Afghan refugees was offered a number of arrivals for that final destination. I'm happy to say that Iowa was one of those states that did step up and continues to step up with Governor Reynolds' leadership and all of our sort of network that has stepped up in welcoming refugees historically. We've talked about that when we first met Charity and keeping that legacy alive and continuing to receive our Afghan residents as well. So we look at what the infrastructure and the capacity of the receiving community is. We, as a statewide coalition, we've really come together to develop an infrastructure that will successfully administer resettlement services and support those who will be arriving to Iowa. We look at places like Des Moines, Sioux City, Council Bluffs, and Cedar Rapids, work with those local communities to ensure that there is an infrastructure and capacity to receive arrivals. So it's been, like I said, a complex process, but one that we are proud of and that we will continue to support not only the legacy of Iowa, but going forward in the future as we welcome new Iowans to the state.
Now, of course, we hear news reports all the time about different communities in Iowa already struggling with having enough housing for people. And yep. Of course, we need to find a safe place for refugee families to settle. Has housing been a real challenge?
Yeah, that's a great question. Housing has been a challenge even prior to this crisis, and I think overall as a social service. But with that, we were able to sort of mitigate some of those challenges through partnerships that we established as a state and as a bureau with not only our local nonprofits, but intergovernmental agencies such as the Iowa Finance Authority. We were able to, as a state, secure emergency rental assistance funds through the federal government to help support some housing costs that families may face. So even though that affordable housing stock may be minimal, these funds and supports allow individuals and families to access market rate housing units. We work very closely with our nonprofit partners and our resettlement agencies who are navigating housing and securing that upfront before one's arrival to ensure that regardless of what is secured, affordable housing, subsidized, or market rate, we have mechanisms in place that post services, it is a sustainable option for our families. And I'm happy to say that that is the case. We worked closely, like I said, with IFA, Iowa Finance Authority, our local agencies, to really secure this funding that will help a lot in the long run, where some of the funds that families and individuals receive through the resettlement agencies, that can be used for furnishings, food, basic necessities, and not focused on housing. So this has been a big help, and I'm happy to say that it's been a challenge that we've been able to tackle head on, and one that we do not foresee in the future that will be a challenge.
Well, and I think it's so hard for most of us to imagine what it would be like to leave everything behind, the home that you've known for your entire life, and travel across the world to go through that whole camp process and then move into a new home really with nothing. And, you know, you're talking about helping people get settled. In just a moment, we're going to talk about volunteer efforts that also support these refugees. Can you tell me briefly what we do give refugees when they come to help them make a life in this housing that we've secured?
Sure. And that's a great question for those who are in this world and within the scope of service. You know, resettlement offers quite a bit. And for the viewers and listeners who may not be privy to resettlement, there are a slew of services that are offered for refugees once they arrive. Not only initial resettlement services, although within a certain timeline, everyone is paired with a case manager and an agency that helps them navigate the system along the way throughout their resettlement process. For those first 90 to 180 days, agencies are securing housing, ensuring families are getting connected to medical services, making sure that the homes are furnished, taking a step back, sorry about that, making sure that depending on the family structure, if there are kids within the K-12 system, they are getting connected to
and
school.
And Mach, stay with us. We're going to have to take a short break. I want to hear more about this in just a moment. Mach Sucheska is Bureau Chief of the Iowa Bureau of Refugee Services based in Des Moines. We're talking about resettling Afghan refugees in Iowa. This is Talk of Iowa.
Support for IPR comes from Orchestra Iowa, presenting the movie E.T., the Extraterrestrial on the big screen, accompanied by the Symphony Orchestra performing the score live, May 3rd and 4th at 7:30 at the Paramount. Tickets at orchestraiowa.com.
Can we heal the environment? In Kansas, we're working on it. Up From Dust is a podcast about how humans reshaped the world to fit urban landscapes and agricultural needs. We'll meet the people who are rolling up their sleeves to find more sustainable ways forward. Listen to Up From Dust from KCUR, part of the NPR network.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We are talking about resettling Afghan refugees in the United States and specifically in Iowa. Coming up in just a moment, I will talk with Aaron Bell of Des Moines Refugee Support, a volunteer organization that tries to make sure that refugees who are resettled in the Des Moines area have everything that they need. With me right now is Mach Sucheska, a bureau chief of the Iowa Bureau of Refugee Services based in Des Moines. And Mach, just before the break, I didn't give you much time, but we were talking about what we do provide for people who are resettled in Iowa. And you were talking about the fact that they have a case manager, and for what, 3 to 6 months, they get help really navigating the agencies that they need and getting health care that they need and making sure that their kids have their access to school. Tell me a little bit more.
Yeah, no, that's a good summary. We also, as a network, through these resettlement organizations, really make sure that employable adults and families have the services they need to get a sustainable job and eventually a career. You know, keeping in mind that when we work with families, we look at the family. We don't necessarily judge them or take them from their circumstances or their status. We get to know these families and what dreams and aspirations they may have. And so when we look at their overall goals for what they want to accomplish, we really try to, as a network, meet them halfway. So through those services and employment opportunities. And so when we take that into consideration, we as a network, which includes the Bureau, refugee resettlement agencies, ethnic community-based organizations, intergovernmental entities, as well as volunteer-based organizations such as that you will talk to in a little bit, we really work with families holistically and try to meet them where they're at. Post-resettlement services, after those 6 months, there are other agencies that step in to sort of fill the gaps where resettlement cannot meet, and that's just given the timeline, not because of the services or lack thereof. It's just because there's a finite time to work with families who are initially resettled here. So when we look at the Bureau of Refugee Services, other ethnic community-based organizations, and agencies that are geared to provide long-term supports, these families are getting those services they need. At the Bureau of Refugee Services, anyone who is eligible for our services is with us for up to 5 years. So we have a much more intense relationship and collaboration with our families and clients, where we really look at the family in depth and what their goals and aspirations are to ensure that there's that sustainable integration moving forward post-services. So even though resettlement and the overall receiving of new refugees is a complex process, there is an infrastructure and capacity here locally that is prepared and geared to work with these families. But most importantly, pair that with our legacy and our ability to navigate some of these nuances and hurdles has really poised Iowa in a good position nationally and regionally as a leader in refugee resettlement. And I don't just say that, Charity, as something to share. It really is the truth. Some of the conversations that I had with my counterparts across the country, they're looking to Iowa to lead. And so that is a testament not only to our state, but the people of Iowa and those who are here to help support refugees and have and will continue to do so.
Can you give me a rough idea of how many Afghan refugees have arrived in Iowa so far?
Yeah, I knew you were going to ask me that question. It's an ever-changing, fluid situation that we're trying to navigate day to day. Right now, we have a little over 200 that have arrived to the state, where we are potentially anticipating through fiscal year 22, somewhere ballpark around 1,000. But that number really can change. It can change after we get off this call today. It can change within the next 48 hours. We're really trying to hone in on what information and data we are receiving from our federal partners, as this is sort of a top-down information sharing type of infrastructure. And so what I can share and what I can say is that regardless of the numbers that we receive and that will arrive to Iowa, we are geared and poised well to help support families, whether that's 200, whether that's 1,000, or anywhere in between, below or above. We have what it takes to help support refugees, and we'll continue to do that.
Do you feel like you have the resources you need to provide culturally appropriate assistance to Afghan refugees? Again, this is an influx of people from a culture that Iowa has not really historically served.
And that's a fair question. We always go, we always look through a lens of culturally and linguistically appropriate services when we are working with non-native English speaking communities. And so that is no exception for our Afghan residents that are arriving to Iowa. Fortunately, we have a small community of Afghan refugees that were resettled here in 2014 and years after. And so we tap into existing resources. We look at our ethnic community-based organization partners to see what kinds of linguistically and culturally services they can provide. We work very closely with our resettlement partners, who have been doing an amazing job across the state in working with our families and really being at the front lines and helping support our Afghan refugees. And then we also look at existing state infrastructures that we have through interpreting services and translation services through the state. So Language Line, Language Link, over the phone interpretation and translation. But overall, we do have a capacity for culturally and linguistically appropriate services, either through interpretation, case management staff that come from these communities, or over the phone translation, as I mentioned. So if we do run into hurdles, we navigate that to the best of our ability. But as of right now, I'm happy to report and confidently report that across the state, we have culturally and linguistically appropriate services.
Mark, thank you so much for talking with me today.
I appreciate it, Charity. Thank you so much.
Mark Sucheska is Bureau Chief of the Iowa Bureau of Refugee Services based in Des Moines. We are talking about welcoming Afghan refugees to Iowa, helping them get settled in the state. We have approximately 200 Afghan refugees that have already arrived in the state of Iowa here at the beginning of winter, a very cold Iowa winter. And of course, they need help getting their households set up and operational. A lot of volunteer groups around the state work with refugees, and one of them is Des Moines Refugee Support. Erin Bell volunteers as a coordinator with Des Moines Refugee Support. She is also Associate Director of Marketing at Drake University and the Live Mascot Program Director, maybe better known as Griff's Mom, and she is on the line with me now. Hello, Erin.
Good morning, Charity.
Oh, Erin, thank you so much for being here. And give me a little bit of background. This is an entirely volunteer-run organization that you just sort of accidentally got involved with. But tell me a little bit about Des Moines Refugee Support.
Yeah, so first of all, thank you so much for having me and for talking to me today. So Des Moines Refugee Support is a local 501c3 nonprofit organization that started about 5 years ago, and it kind of started within the Des Moines public school system. A group of teachers, an individual teacher really started it, and so a lot of our volunteers are teachers, but definitely not only teachers, and we just work really hard to kind of fill in the gaps within the refugee community in Des Moines by doing whatever we can to support these families that are new to the area. We also try very hard to give some of the refugee kids kind of normal childhood experiences that they might not otherwise have the opportunity to do.
So with you've been working mostly with refugees from African countries recently, and now there's a new population of refugees getting resettled in Des Moines. Can you tell me a little bit about when you first started hearing that Afghan refugees were coming to Iowa?
Yeah, so like you said, a lot of our refugees that we had until very recently have been from African countries, also lots of people from Burma, some Asian countries. So the Afghan population is definitely new to us, and we've kind of been waiting for several months as we watched things transpire on the news and, you know, from Afghanistan. And we knew that they would be coming, and we've just kind of been anxiously waiting their arrival. And all of a sudden, there's a big rush of people arriving to Des Moines. And so now we are definitely jumping into action and working pretty much around the clock to try to support these resettlement agencies and everybody else that is working to help these people transition to Des Moines.
And what is your relationship with sort of the official process? I mean, you are helping individuals and you are collecting items and making sure that people have what they need. But how do you work with these agencies?
Yeah, so we are here to support however we can help, we will do it. And so we've been contacted by several case managers with Catholic Charities to, you know, fill in some of the gaps that these families still have. And so we've just kind of been supporting their efforts and working closely with some of these case managers to help the families that they are serving.
With this new group, there have been some really culturally specific needs for the Afghan refugees. Can you tell me a little bit about really how you have assessed what people need?
Yeah, so it did not take us very long to figure out kind of the top five or six items that really make Afghans feel connected to their culture and make them feel a little bit more at home here. They love tea. So we have distributed a large number of teapots and kind of hot water carafes that they use regularly. They also do a lot of cooking with pressure cookers, not the fancy instant pot kinds that we are used to seeing around here, but kind of the just basic pressure cookers. So we have been distributing those to families. And then sewing machines. Sewing is, I have not yet met an Afghan woman that does not sew. And so providing them with a sewing machine really empowers them to kind of take control of some things. They're able to make their clothing that they much prefer to our clothing. And so just things like that that we have identified are just really significant to them. They also, you know, the ones that we have met sleep on the floor. And so they like to have area rugs. So area rugs are very a hot commodity right now. So we've collected a lot of those. We're trying to get at least one area rug to people. And then they like to sit and lean against and kind of get comfortable with large pillows, large floor pillows. So we have tried to provide that for them as well so that they can kind of feel a little bit more at home. They eat on the floor. They sleep on the floor. They socialize on the floor. So that has been really important as well. So we're working to provide those things.
I know that you had an experience last week where you were helping a family, a husband and wife with a young child, and were able to help secure a sewing machine for the family and some fabric. And it was really an opportunity for you to see how this could empower an individual. Can you tell me, I don't want to violate anybody's confidentiality, of course, but can you just tell me a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, so I had been connected with this family that you speak of, and they had been just really struggling emotionally and just feeling really lost. And, you know, they've got all the support from the resettlement agencies and the case managers and things like that, but they were still just really having a hard time. And so, you know, I met them and got a list of the things that they would like to have for their home and things that would make them more comfortable. And, you know, we got them food and all kinds of things. But sewing machine was one of the items, which is pretty standard and for these families. And so we were able to get them a sewing machine. And then I took her shopping for fabric, and she picked out some things to make some clothes for herself, because, you know, these people are coming with, you know, maybe a suitcase of things from home. So she didn't have much clothes, and the next time I went over there, she had made herself a traditional Afghan outfit. I wish I knew the word for it, but I don't. I think it's been called a frock. But she had sewn one for herself, and then she had also sewn a matching one for her baby, which was so cute. And her whole entire presentation had changed. She was smiling. She was so proud of herself. And I just think it really did a lot more than what it looks like on the surface. And ever since then, I really feel that her whole emotional status has changed, and the whole family's dynamic has changed. She told me how she FaceTimed with her family back in Afghanistan and was showing them, you know, this outfit that she had made, and how they couldn't believe that people here were helping her to do that and things like that. So I just feel like there's a lot of hope in that sewing machine, and I think that it has truly changed their experience so far.
Now, I mentioned there are other nonprofits around the state that are also supporting refugees. You can follow Des Moines Refugee Support on Facebook. And Aaron, I know you keep people posted about the things that you need. What are your main needs right now? And that can probably give us insight into what some other nonprofits might also be looking for.
Yeah. So, you know, area rugs are big, and they are also expensive, so they're kind of they're harder for us to purchase for people. So anything that is in good condition and clean, we love those. The basic pressure cookers, teapots, any hygiene products, we've been distributing a lot of those to these families, and they definitely have a need for those things. Curtains, fabric, you know, they can sew. They're amazing sewers, and we are collecting sewing machines, but fabric is really expensive. So we are working with some sewing groups around the area to get some of their donations from them. So fabric is big, sewing tools, large stock pots, tea kettles, hot water carafes, those kinds of things are just invaluable.
And I'm sure monetary donations also help you out a lot as you try to secure the things that people need.
Yes, absolutely.
Well, Erin, thank you so much for all you do for the community, and thank you so much for talking with me.
Thank you very much, Charity.
Erin Bell volunteers as a coordinator with Des Moines Refugee Support. They support refugee families from anywhere in the world, but recently have been working with a number of Afghan families. She also works for Drake University. She's the Associate Director of Marketing and Director of the Live Mascot Program. She's also Griff and Griff 2's mom. Coming up in just a moment, we will talk about It's a Wonderful Life. This is Talk of Iowa.
Can we heal the environment? In Kansas, we're working on it. Up From Dust is a podcast about how humans reshaped the world to fit urban landscapes and agricultural needs. We'll meet the people who are rolling up their sleeves to find more sustainable ways forward. Listen to Up From Dust from KCUR, part of the NPR network.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. It's a Wonderful Life, starring Jimmy Stewart and Iowa's own Donna Reed, debuted in 1946. The film shows us the life of George Bailey, a small-town guy who, although eager to go off into the world to seek adventure, stays in his town to run the family business, a struggling building and loan. He experiences many disappointments on a personal level, but he also helps all of those around him. The film shows his life through flashbacks, building to a crisis where George considers taking his own life. He is stopped by his guardian angel. Here's the scene where they meet.
Look, who are you?
I told you, George, I'm your guardian angel.
Yeah, I know. You told me that. You a hypnotist?
No, of course not.
Well, then why am I seeing all these strange things?
Don't you understand, George? It's because you were not born.
Well, if I wasn't born, who am I?
You're nobody. You have no identity.
Oh, what do you mean, no identity? My name's George Bailey.
There is no George Bailey. You've been given a great gift, George. A chance to see what the world would be like without you.
It's a Wonderful Life has become a Christmas classic, and although it fills many with nostalgia, it also gives us a glimpse into some of the very difficult struggles of the 1920s, 30s, and 40s in the United States. Leo Landis is state curator of the State Historical Society of Iowa. He'll be hosting a free webinar about the history portrayed in the film tomorrow at noon as part of his Iowa History 101 series, and he is on the line with me now. Hello, Leo.
Good morning, Charity. Quick note, it's on Thursday.
Sorry about that. I got ahead of myself.
I appreciate it, though, so thank you.
All right, Thursday at noon. Be there or be square. All right, Leo, Bedford Falls is a small town. Some people try to say that it's in upstate New York, but it really is a town that could be anywhere in the United States. Tell me a little bit about what you see in how the scene is set in this film.
Sure, and I just want to say I'll be joined by a former colleague from Henry Ford Museum, Christopher Wilson, who's the Director of Experience Design at National Museum of American History. And so we'll be looking at the film and how United States and world history is represented through the film. And it's a really great film in marching you through some really significant events, as you said, in that 1920s to 1940s period. And so while it's a vehicle to tell the story of George Bailey and why his life really is rewarding, the scenes that were portrayed in the film and that people in 1946 and early 1947 watching it, had either just lived through or if you were in your 30s, had lived through, you know, in the 19-teens. So, so much that gets carried through in the film references historical events.
Yeah, and of course, George Bailey's life is told through flashbacks. His guardian angel has to do his homework before he comes down to Earth to save George Bailey. So he has to learn all about him. And we see these flashbacks, and they take us to some of these incredibly important periods in our history, although in a small way. I mean, we glimpse, for example, the flu pandemic. Tell me a little bit about what we see.
Sure. For people that don't know the film, and those who do will recognize the scene, of course, but George is a, you know, elementary school student, is working in the local drugstore, Mr. Gower's drugstore, and sees Mr. Gower has received a telegram and is distraught and, in fact, is inebriated. And so in reading it, realizes, A, Mr. Gower has put something poisonous into some pills that would kill someone, but sees that Mr. Gower has received a telegram, and it actually does have a date on it when George reads it. It's May 3rd, 1919. So the, you know, what would probably have been the third wave of the influenza pandemic that began in the spring of 1918. And so Mr. Gower's son has died from influenza. It says, "We regret to inform you that your son Robert died very suddenly this morning of influenza." And of course, that's a topic you and I have discussed, and others going back to 1918 and 1919. But if you were 30 years old and watching the film, that was certainly something, or older, you had lived through, and just the devastation of young people who were the ones who were dying of that influenza pandemic. So that's something that people watching the film knew, and of course, we understand a little bit from our own perspective today.
Yeah, well, and you mentioned that Mr. Gower is inebriated in that scene. There's actually a lot of alcohol consumption in the film, which is also significant because of the time that a lot of these scenes take place, really in the Prohibition era, right?
That's certainly right, and that's one of, you know, the character Annie, and that is only how she is billed. She's the one, you know, larger black character in the film. She's a maid for the Bailey family, and in the first scene where she really appears, George and Harry Bailey, the two brothers, their father is still alive, and so it's Harry's graduation day party in 1928, and Annie, the maid, is serving dinner and, you know, says, "Boys and girls, you know, who needs gin?" Because Harry is a graduating senior, presumably in 1928, during Prohibition, is interested in perhaps having some alcohol. And Annie, at least, is the mortal voice saying, "Who needs gin?" And then, of course, Harry's there, Mr. Bailey, chimes in and says, "Yeah, no gin tonight, Harry." So we definitely know it's Prohibition in that scene.
Right. Well, and that also gives us a little bit of understanding of the family and maybe what side of issues they stood on at that point in time.
Exactly.
So
the Baileys may not have, you know, been adhering strictly to Prohibition.
There also is a little touchstone. Of course, we know that Herbert Hoover was the only president elected from the state of Iowa, and we don't get a glimpse of Herbert Hoover, although this was his time. But we do get a glimpse of his competition, right?
That's right, and it also ties into that Prohibition issue. So the election of 1928, the two major candidates are Herbert Hoover for the Republican Party, and the Republican Party had been really the party of Prohibition through the late 1800s into the actual enactment of Prohibition. And then the candidate who is nominated on the Democratic side is Al Smith, governor of New York, the first Catholic to be nominated by a major party. And the scene where you know that's the case is, again, for people that don't know the film well, the two main characters, I should say, are Ernie the taxi cab driver and Bert the policeman, or Bert the cop. And Bert the police officer is holding a newspaper from the Bedford Falls newspaper that says Smith wins nomination. So that may be a little out of continuity because it's also the same day, I think, that Harry's party is held. So if it's, you know, sometime in May, Smith may not have quite wrapped up that nomination, but he was the wet candidate. That was one of the big issues in that 1928 election. Would prohibition persist, or was this Catholic candidate who was generally regarded as you know, being soft on alcohol, what did that mean for our country? And so you see Bert, the police officer, holding that newspaper.
Well, it's amazing how many of these little touches there are, because obviously all of this was extremely intentional in the creation of the film.
Oh, exactly right. You know, and I think we'll probably get to this and not knowing where the break will fall if we have one. But that same day then, and you and I have talked about the dancing of the 1920s, again, it's a little out of continuity, but that at the high school, Bedford Falls High School graduation party for Harry Bailey, again, the younger brother of George, there's a Charleston dance competition, and that's one that I hadn't looked at hard until Chris and I had been talking about this film. And there were Charleston dance competitions were the big thing in Iowa and across the United States in early 1926. They start taking off in 1925, but there are ads and competitions all over Iowa, Davenport, Sioux City, Oskaloosa, Des Moines. You see these Charleston dance competitions taking place. And in fact, the Oskaloosa one was segregated. They had a white competition in February of 1926 on a Thursday night for white dancers, and then on the next night they had a competition for black dancers. So they were popular enough that they were held all over the state, but in Oskaloosa and at least one other town, Dubuque, also had a competition for black dancers.
So segregated competitions. And while we're talking about race, you mentioned the character of the maid of the family, and she's a very stereotypical character, I would say. Not a role that really gave that actress much to do.
No, and that was the case for so many black actors and actresses of the 1930s and 1940s, you know, and even beyond, is where oftentimes placed in stereotypical roles. She's, you know, a single woman and has about 2 minutes of dialogue total in the film. So,
well, and she pretty much, I mean, given that at the time it was illegal to marry outside of one's race, the fact that we don't see any other black people pretty much in Bedford Falls, she didn't have a lot of choices as far as being single or not from the vision that we see. And I mean, that is significant. When we look at this American community, it does not look like America.
Not really. And when you do see other black characters, it's either if it's in the real time, they're usually in the background. So when the Martini family is getting their house moving to Bailey Park, it happens just in a few seconds across the screen. There's a black woman and a black child in the background of that scene. And until I was looking hard at just other parts of the film, hadn't even seen them. And I started watching this film in the mid-1980s when I was in college, when it was really going back into big rotation. And so it's a film I've been paying attention to for, you know, over 40 years now almost. And something that, or 35, we'll be more accurate on years. So 35 years, and had really not seen those characters. And then in the dream, or then the flashback sequence where George had never lived, then it's where blacks and Italians are portrayed as dangerous because what had been the Martini's bar becomes Nick's bar, and it's really a gin joint that, you know,
with sort of a mafia-esque environment.
Yeah. Exactly, which Frank Capra, as a Italian immigrant, certainly was aware of that stereotype too.
Well, the immigration issues do play an important role in the film. And again, as a casual viewer, I'm not sure you'd think very hard about this, but that's one of the main points of conflict between George Bailey, our hero, although I will argue that Donna Reed is the true hero of Mary Hatch and Mary Bailey later on.
She saves it, yeah.
She certainly does. but this is between George Bailey and Potter, this terrible man that tries to make everybody in the community's life miserable as he gets richer and richer all the time. He's very anti-immigrant and has these nativist sentiments that were very common during that time, whereas George Bailey is supportive of immigrants and actually helps them find affordable homes.
Exactly right. The scene with Bailey Park and, you know, again, that ties into Great Depression era activities that, again, if you know the history, the Federal Home Administration is promoting, affordable housing through the 1930s and 1940s. It's actually the organization, too, that creates redlining. But in the film, it's how the Martinis are able to, you know, an obviously Italian family. They're Italian Catholic, in fact, because you see them both crossing themselves, doing the sign of the cross when they get their home from George and Mary Bailey presenting the house to them as they're moving in. And yet Potter, when he's criticizing George, says, you know, he could have said worse things, but it's certainly, not said in a favorable way, is that, you know, what are you doing with your life, George? You're you know, building a bunch of homes, and he uses the slur garlic eaters. So just some, you know, as you said, just some awful nativist sentiments are being represented. And that was part of the 1920s and 1930s, where Italian Americans are really trying to prove their Americanness. And as you see people like Joe DiMaggio in baseball, Frank Sinatra in entertainment is how Italian Americans are becoming more American. And again, Frank Capra, being an immigrant himself, was certainly aware of that.
Now, I think a lot of people love to watch this film because of that strong message of optimism and perseverance and the idea that we are all making an impact on others' lives, even if we can't see it in the moment. Looking at this film through the lens of a historian, which I realize you probably haven't been able to look at anything without the lens of a historian for many decades, but thinking about, you know, somebody thinking more about the history in this film, what do you think is important about that frame of mind and what we can gain from that?
I think that message that you've emphasized just in the leading into the question, you know, really is what's heartwarming about the film, but also just understanding the broader context of American history, that the way it is represented either indirectly or indirectly in the film, that, you know, the American dream that's being represented, and this film's done, you know, just as we've defeated a year after the defeat of the Nazis and the Japanese, that the American dream still wasn't fully realized. So if you look at the film title, It's a Wonderful Life, we still had segregation in our country, still a lot of challenges in 1946, and yet Frank Capra, who really he had done actually a film on the black soldier during World War II and why they were fighting. And so trying to promote that inclusive idea of a wonderful life for all Americans, it's still unrealized. I think Frank Capra knew, but this is a film that starts to, you know, try to promote that idea, and it's not fully realized as a wonderful life, but it's a good lens into American history.
It also is a just radiant role for Iowa's own Donna Reed. I think that she, I love Jimmy Stewart, but I really feel like Donna Reed is one of the main reasons to watch this film. What do you think?
I agree. And in fact, you know, one of the key scenes that we'll talk about, too, that has an important reference that Chris and I both know well is when, you know, George and Mary are sharing a phone call before they're, you know, a couple. And Sam Wainwright, who is a erstwhile suitor of Mary, you know, says, tell George it's the chance of a lifetime. And Sam Wainwright's referencing a business opportunity, but the real chance of a lifetime is for them to become a couple. And so Donna Reed does such a great job in the film. It's really a great role for her.
Well, Leo Landis, thank you so much for talking with me and for giving me a new way to look at this classic film.
You are welcome, Charity. Thank you.
Happy holidays to you. Leo Landis is State Curator of the State Historical Society of Iowa. He will be hosting a free webinar about the history portrayed in the film It's a Wonderful Life Thursday at noon as part of his Iowa History 101 series. This is Talk of Iowa. I'm Charity Nebbe.